Hello and welcome to the Musicians Met podcast. I'm Kane Power. There are so many elements to music production that creating and releasing music can seem like completing a puzzle. It can be hard to know which pieces go where and in what order things need to be done. If you don't have any knowledge of or training with the technical aspects of making music, terms like tracking, mixing, and mastering can be confusing when you just want to get your songs out there. Let's say you've got a recording you're proud of and you want to share it with the world, but you're not sure if it's up to the expected sonic standard. Your song sounds a little flat and quiet, and you're worried it might not compare to other artists in your genre. What do you do? This week, we're talking about mastering. What is it? Why do we need it? And can you do it yourself? We're delving into the world of audiophile wizardry to uncover everything you need to know about preparing your tracks for release, and a whole lot more. If you're already familiar with mastering and the ideas behind it, you'll still find value here, as we go into the philosophy behind why mastering engineers exist and where the craft is heading. To help provide some expert opinion and philosophical guidance, my guest this week is Kevin Tuffy. Kevin is a mastering engineer and audio specialist who has worked in recording, mixing, mastering, and audio restoration for more than a decade. More recently, Kevin can be found mastering some of the world's finest artists out of Metropolis Mastering in London. We caught up over Skype. Kev, welcome to the Musicians Met podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Kane.
Let's talk about the world of mastering. We'll keep it kind of basic for people just starting out and trying to figure out what mastering is. So maybe we could start with that and sort of start with a sort of a basis for the listeners. What is mastering from your kind of professional perspective?
So I think it's probably important to understand with mastering where it comes from, the kind of historical context of what, like, why it was originally done. So, you know, the original mastering engineers were disc cutters. So back then, you know, the steps of making a record went, you know, your kind of producer who was recording to a, maybe like a 2-inch tape, 24 track, would get passed on to the mix engineer who would mix maybe from a 2-inch down to a 1/4-inch or a 1/2-inch 2-track. And then really the mastering engineer kind of came in because he or she had a really good understanding of the final format of the disc, of the vinyl. So they would have a kind of specific expertise set of skill set and an understanding about that final format that maybe the producer or the mix engineer wouldn't really need or wouldn't have that understanding. So I think that's probably where the mastering engineer came from. That's why we exist at all. While the producer and the mix engineer are thinking very creatively about how can I make this record just sound really good, the mastering engineer is kind of thinking, how can I make this record sound really good, i.e. the actual record, the format, the final, sure, the final thing that's taking that music to the consumer, the listener, and optimizing that mix, essentially, you know, so that when it gets to the listener, it works for that format that they're listening in. So I think that's probably where it's kind of come from, and where we are today is that's my world now, is that I'm thinking about mastered for iTunes or, you know, codecs for compressing stuff for MP3. These are kind of conversations that mastering engineers are having about how we can get the most out of that and, you know, make sure that mix that we get, you know, that's what comes to us, that when we pass it on and it's going into consumer world, getting either bought or streamed or listened to, that it fits that, you know, that format and it sounds great. So I think that's probably, without getting into the kind of geeky nitty-gritty of what that entails and how you do that, that is why the mastering engineer exists, and that's why they continue to exist, and that's why they're important. So
yeah, can you give us an overall summary of maybe some of the technical processes that mastering accomplishes, or that you undergo during mastering to make a track adhere to those standards that you're talking about?
A really important part of the mastering process is, just on a really basic level, is just like the volume. You know, if you've got three or four mix engineers working across a record, and they're all kind of hitting different volumes with their mixes, that the mastering engineer has to take all of those mixes together and make them work together within the context of the record, so that, you know, track one going into track two doesn't suddenly dip 6 dB. With the older stuff with vinyl, there's physical, because it's a physical format, there's physical limitations of vinyl. So, you know, with newer formats, with Spotify and stuff, these kind of things, there aren't physical limitations. It's a digital file. It's going to end up a digital file that's going to go on a big server, and the people who log in and have accounts and listen to stuff. We're thinking in those terms now. So we're kind of thinking, how do I want to deliver my master so that when it goes through the process of being compressed down, you know, and the kind of MP3 process, what little kind of tricks can we do so that the degradation, you know, there is some degradation, those codecs sound really great, and people are doing these at higher resolutions and stuff now as the technology changes. It's getting better, but there's still little things that we can do that we can listen to, and we have tools to kind of make sure that, hey, you know, when this becomes an MP3, I still want it to sound as close to the WAV file, the high-res file that I delivered.
Yeah.
So we have little tricks like this. So this is kind of what occupies the mastering engineer's mind, you know, as well as like EQing, which I'm sure we'll get on to talking about, but just on the most kind of base level, this is why we exist. This is what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And then maybe we'll use some of these tools, these EQ tools and compression and limiting, to get those, you know, to achieve those things where it gets to the final product.
Let's actually talk about that stuff right now. So say I send you a track, let's say a good home studio recording, and say, can you please master my track, Kev? What's the kind of just a really basic outline of the sort of things that you would do? I'm intending just to release it on Spotify.
Okay, so the first thing I'm probably going to look out for is the overall volume of the track, and obviously we're in digital world, so you might have sent me something that you know the highest peak is 0 dBFS. So as far as you're concerned, you know, that's the loudest it can be, and you know, there's some truth in that from a certain perspective. But you know, say Spotify, I listen to Spotify, I'll have it on my phone, you know, when I'm on the tube and stuff. The first consideration I want to make is, if your home recording is going on and it's going to be next to a whole bunch of other records that are out, New Music Friday or whatever, that I don't want everyone to flick through all the New Music Friday and get to your track and then suddenly it's like huge dip and it's way quieter. Someone's sitting on the train, they can't even hear the song because it's the train volume is louder than the volume kicking out of their iPhone or Android or whatever. So straight away I'm going to think about volume and how I can achieve that. The most obvious tool in my arsenal is going to be a limiter, or possibly a couple of limiters. So that's, I'm going to be kind of achieving the volume thing with that. The next thing that's going to come into consideration, if it's a home recording, is that you might have mixed it on some pretty good speakers in a room that you know really well, but there's going to be probably some elements of that room where there's funny nodes, there's funny little dips, there's certain frequencies that you don't kind of pick up in that room just because it's not been built by scientists to be, you know, clinically flat. Yeah. And even with a professional studio, you'll have people, producers, mixers moving around from maybe country to country. They might go to where the band are, they might go to where the artists are. You know, the producer might say, this band feel really comfortable in their home studio, so I'm going to go record with them there because that's where we're going to get the best vibe for the record. But that producer's maybe only going to do that one record there. So even if they're the best producer, they're now working in an environment that they're not familiar with. Your mastering guy is probably going to have been sitting in that room for, you know, anywhere from a couple to 20 to 30 years. Mm. They'll know that room intimately. So any kind of little thing that the mixer or the producer has missed, You know, your mastering engineer is your quality control. This is your last check. He's going to go, he or she is going to go, ah, that's cool. You've missed that one little thing. I'm just going to tidy that up. It's all going to sound great. So that's kind of why we exist and what we do. And yeah, like I said, the limiting with the volume thing is probably the first thing we're looking for. Mm. Any EQ things, we're going to have some pretty precision EQs, you know, that's either in the box or on the board. EQs that kind of can really deal with the very lows, the very highs, and be able to clean up any of those things that we hear that need to be leveled out. And then we send the master back, and everybody involved in the project gets to hear that final thing, and then it gets shipped off for production, I suppose.
Yeah,
I don't want to say production, because distribution, you know, like the actual producing the final thing, whether that is someone clicking a button to upload it to Spotify or whether it's you know, burning up a whole load of CDs. That's where we kind of come in, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, so you mentioned the mix engineer and the mix process and the production process. Obviously, you know, that process has a huge part in determining how the final track will sound. And, you know, once you get a track, there's only a certain amount you can do to it. But let's backtrack a bit and kind of highlight the difference between mixing a track and mastering a track.
So the mix engineer, the source audio that they work from is a multi-track. So they've got free rein to control the levels, the EQ, the compression, all of these things. We're using the same tools, but they're doing it to a bass drum, an 808, a hi-hat, a lead vocal, a backing vocal. By the time it comes to us, it's already in the stereo world. So I'm kind of reticent to say this, but because we can't alter someone, send me a track and go, I think the vocal needs to be louder. Well, I can't do that. That's the mix engineer. Sometimes you use an EQ or a compressor and it can give the impression that the vocal is louder. So I suppose there's a little bit of ambiguity there, but generally, you know, I'm working from a two track. So all of those decisions, have been made, and all of those sonic qualities of the track now have been determined. Mm. And what I'm doing is much broader brush strokes. If the producer's kind of cutting up all bits of wood, he's going to give them on to the mix engineer. The mix engineer is going to assemble those bits of wood into a table. By the time it gets to me, it's already a table, so I can polish it, but the legs are where they are, and the tabletop's where it is. If one of the legs is a bit short and it's kind of, you know, rocking back and forth, I've only got some sandpaper and some polish, so you know that I can't really do. I'm just gonna, at the very most, I'm gonna stick a beer mat under one of those legs and hope that it kind of stays stable. So,
yeah.
But you know, on the flip side as well, a mastering engineer, I guess most of the time you're getting a track that's been mixed. You know, the management, the A&R, the artist, the producer, all of these people have signed it off. They're all happy with it. Otherwise, it wouldn't have made it as far as me. So, I'm kind of the belief that the mastering engineer shouldn't kind of alter the fundamentals of the track. You're just there to enhance what's already great about it, and you don't want to kind of send back a master that suddenly sounds, the biggest thing is always going to be maybe the volume jump. Some mix engineers mix pretty close to the end stop, and they mix pretty hot, so even that you're not going to change much. But some guys mix with, you know, 6, sometimes 12 dB of headroom. So the really obvious thing that's going to pop out is that it's suddenly louder. But the other things are going to be subtler, but hopefully, like, you know, that's what you want to do. You want to improve it. You don't want to fuck it up. So it could be a bit brighter. It could be a little bit bassier. It could be a bit punchier, but you know, you're in the kind of, it's why we call it the dark art. You're in the kind of ambiguous adjectives with regards to what we're doing. Whereas a mix engineer, if you're not happy with the mix, you're going to be saying like, that kick drum needs to come up, that vocal needs to go down, you know, it all needs to sound more distorted. These are much bigger, more noticeable changes that the mix engineer is making. The mastering engineer is a subtler kind of discipline, I think.
Yeah, totally. What about for our listeners who may be thinking, can I master my own tracks? Do I need to send my tracks to a mastering engineer? I've recorded them. I've kind of done the best sort of mix I can. I'm really happy with how it sounds. Can I do it myself?
It can be done, and obviously you should try to make whatever piece of music sound as good as possible with the resources available. I think the benefits you get from having different people being like maybe the songwriter, maybe the producer, maybe the mixer, and then the mastering engineer is that you have more ears listening to that eventually that record's going to get listened, you know, you would hope as the creator of that music by as many ears as possible. Mm. So it's better to have five sets of ears, make sure that you've kind of got everything right before it goes out to the big wide world, than one set of ears, because then when it suddenly gets listened to by a million people and, you know, these little blemishes and mistakes that are maybe in there, 2 years later, I hear this from mix engineers. I mean, I've done this with stuff that I mastered years ago that I've gone back and gone, oh man, I could have done that better now, you know. If you don't have those ears on it, the more ears you get on it before it's out in the big wide world, the more confident you can be that you've got it as best as you, you know, possibly can. So I think that's where the benefits come from. Mm. If there is no budget, I think, and you just want to, you know, this is something you just really want to get out there, reference as much as possible, especially within the kind of sonic palette of what you're doing. Get your mix right and do all that bit. Leave yourself a little bit of headroom. Maybe, I don't know if someone's working in like Pro Tools or Logic or Ableton, but get that down to two track, get it how you like it, you know, so that you've self-approved the mix. Then get it into maybe a new session and pull in a couple of tracks so that you can reference them for volume, for you know, overall, for how punchy it is, for how warm it is, bright, the bottom end, that the kind of levels of the kick are right and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, if you're already doing this, if you're home recording or you're home mixing, you're going to have some, presumably some plugins that do this. You're going to have limiters, you're going to have compressors, maybe multiband compressors and EQs. And then you can start to utilize those and manipulate them and try and kind of reference some other stuff. And then when it's as close to where you want it to be, and then that's your master, you know, you whoever is the mastering engineer in that moment, you know, just because someone, you know, says it on your, at the end of your email that you're a mastering engineer, you know, anyone can do it. But like I say, I think there's a massive benefit to having that collaborative workflow. But sometimes I understand as well that that's not always possible depending on the project. So,
So
I think people can be their own mastering engineers, but you would get someone else to do it, just like anything. If you want it the best possible, you want someone with that experience, you're paying them for their experience and their ear and their tools.
And it comes down to how you're trying to represent yourself to the market and how you're trying to put across your sound. Like, how many times do you do the cheaper option? You know, do you record at home and then do you mix at home and then do you master at home and your track has cost you a sum total of $0, but maybe it doesn't sound as good as if you'd done it in a studio with a real mix engineer and then sent it to a real mastering engineer. I can definitely support the multiple ears argument. I mean, I've mastered a couple of records that I've done on my own. You know, it's records that I've made. I have mastered a couple of them, and they're never as good as when I send it as when I send it to someone else. Firstly, because I'm not really a mastering engineer, but secondly, because you're close to the project, and so I mix it how I think it should sound, and then I master it, and I kind of go, oh well, it kind of just needs to be a bit louder and a bit wider and a bit brighter, and hey, there we are, you know. But what I've done in the past is, on some recordings that I've spent a lot of time with, I've written the music, I've recorded it, and I've mixed it. I'll send it to a mastering engineer, and then I'll master it myself, and then I'll listen to what the mastering engineer gives me. And I've, you know, always planning on paying the mastering engineer for their work, regardless of, you know, of which one I choose. But you know what? I've never ever chosen my own. It's always been beneficial to have a professional, another set of ears, checking out my mixes.
If you are going to go down that road, the best possible thing you could do to get the best result on a shoestring is try and mix it and master it. If you can't, you know, if you can get into someone else's studio, do it in a different studio. You want to hear it. You need, it's that difference of opinion and it's that objective. I know what you're saying about being too close to something, you know, that does happen. And you know, there's not really much you can do about that, but maybe like, don't then master it in the same place that you mix it, because you're just going to hear it exactly as you heard it while you were mixing.
Yeah.
And if possible, leave a gap as well, you know, maybe mix everything, get to the point, and then, you know, the track that you mixed 2 weeks ago, when you sit down with it again, your ears, because your ears will hear stuff how you want it to sound sometimes, and you're not actually hearing it exactly as it is.
What about, now, everyone that's listening who's considering getting their stuff mastered will have seen this, and I've seen it, and you've seen it. What about the sites that offer online mastering, you know, for $20 a song or something like that, you know, like cheap online mastering, sent, you know, get your tracks sounding like the pros kind of thing. Have you got any experience with them? Are they legit?
Well, it kind of depends, because I know that there's some really big mastering house. I mean, the mastering house that I work at offers online mastering, you know, yeah, Abbey Roads and all this kind of stuff. If you're sending it to Abbey Road and maybe you're getting an assistant or someone like that, the likelihood is that they're going to be using that same equipment. They're going to be listening to it on monitors. So you're getting a lot of the stuff that you would want from your mastering sort of session, you're still going to get. Maybe you can't attend. You probably can't attend, not for $20 a track.
No.
But so there's certain things that you're going to lose out on attending, picking the engineer, maybe getting that same kind of dialogue where you can sort of talk them through the process and have revisions and all that kind of stuff. So there is a chance that you're going to send it, get it back, and not like what they've done, and maybe it's not going to work out. But I would say it's still a better option than not mastering at all. And then, like I say, if you have got the budget, if you can go to an engineer that you know and trust, if you can maybe attend the session. The really good thing about mastering is with the kind of mastering rooms is that because the monitoring is so flat and so trustworthy, that's what we like at our studio, is that there's that collaborative potential to have the client come in, and what they're hearing and what everybody in that room is hearing, sometimes the A&R will come in, sometimes the manager, we're all kind of hearing the true representation of that song. There's not gonna be like a huge bump at 1K in the monitoring that's gonna, you know, make it sound completely different.
Mm.
Not to say that it won't then sound different when you take away in the car or whatever, because, you know, a car doesn't sound like a giant set of PMCs, but that's kind of what's good about the mastering, is if you can attend, then you can be there and hear it as it is and go, that's how I want the record to sound. This is cool. I can sign this off right now, and that's, I'm happy for that to go to the manufacturing plant or go up on Spotify. So,
yeah.
You're going to lose benefits by using those online stuff. I mean, some of them may be a little bit kind of like a scam, like you don't even know what the studio is. But if you send it once and you can spend $20 that one time and it comes back and you're happy, then maybe you've got, you know, a resource that you can start using and going, well, I'll send it there. It's a different set of ears. It's a different set of monitors. It's somebody else's opinion. It's somebody else's take. And you kind of get quite a lot of the stuff from the mastering process that you're after. So
yeah,
I think they're okay.
But maybe look into Metropolis or something for their online mastering rather than onlinemasteringforyou.com.
Yeah, maybe. Like, well, maybe. I mean,
maybe. Yeah, maybe. Okay. So, what about if someone wanted to? They can't afford to get their tracks mastered. They're going to do it themselves. What do you need, and what sort of resources do you need to learn to do it?
I mean, I'm kind of a big proponent of the like 10,000 hours thing. I think just doing it loads over and over again on lots of different stuff is a good thing to do. Anyone who's kind of doing that is probably going to start off in the plugin world. I mean, the plugins, I kind of am always amazed at how much they improve all the time. And some of the stuff that's coming out now, it's just absolutely mind blowing. So there's some really affordable stuff out there. That's some of the UAD stuff. I know it's probably a bit more expensive, but you know, if you get them on sale and stuff, there's some really great plugins that you can maybe get for less than, I'm sort of talking in pounds because I'm in the UK, but for less than £100 for some like really mind blowing plugins that I find myself turning to every single day. So you kind of want to read the reviews, go on the sort of chat rooms and listen to mastering engineers and find out who's using what. And I think you'll find quite a lot of consensus on some stuff. And I think just doing it over and over again, constantly referencing records. If you hear a record that you like the way it sounds, and hopefully you like the record too, the artistry, but if you hear that, constantly referencing that and going, okay, why doesn't Mark, what's missing from this that I'm doing that doesn't sound like that? And keep experimenting, and you'll find that over time you get closer and closer to that great record that you think sounds amazing. Your records are getting closer to sounding like that great record. So
yeah, I would agree as well. You know, you can look at some YouTube tutorials and maybe look at some ebooks or some books or something. But I think in the end, it's about referencing what you're doing to what you're hearing in the wider marketplace, because that's what people are listening to. That's what the accepted kind of standard is. Referencing is extremely important, and doing it over and over again until you kind of understand what you're hearing and what you're doing.
And it's just that, you know, that level of experimenting a lot and changing stuff and trying to listen critically and training your ear. And when I say training your ear, it's not like there's a Rocky montage and you're running along a beach with boxing gloves and stuff, but just listening and going, okay, if the attack's slower, how does that sound? How is that affecting the sound? How's it affecting the bottom end? How's it affecting the top end? And, you know, that's where you get into the kind of multi-band compression world of setting different attacks and release times at different frequencies, and how do they respond? And, you know, how does that affect the balance of the mix? How is that opening up the bottom end, or does the bottom end now sound like much more closed and claustrophobic? And doing that at all the different bands. And so I think, yeah, just kind of doing that and listening to what you're doing and kind of stupid stuff. I mean, obviously what you're saying about YouTube tutorials and books, and also if you get to sit in with like an engineer and learn from them, or you get into a position where you're in that world, then that's a huge thing as well. You can learn so much in so little time. But if you are restricted from some of those, yeah, just going around and listening critically to each of those things and kind of trying to, you know, think about how does this sound? How has this changed the sound? Do I like it? Do I not like it? And really think about those things. And it'll, doing it over and over again and that repetition, you'll start to find yourself like moving towards certain things, and some things will start coming automatically, and you'll know that setting something in a specific way will give you that sound that you crave, that you want it to sound like that, and then yeah, the records will start sounding really good. So yeah, it's a process, but and there's no overnight way to do it, but the more you do it, and it just keeps making more and more sense. Yeah. But yeah, you want to get the basics right first.
Totally. And okay, say we have got the basics right. Say we've, you know, recorded a track, we've mixed it, and we're preparing to master it. What are the kind of basic requirements in terms of sample rate and bit rate that people need to think about? Firstly, maybe for those who have no idea what those mean, maybe we could get a really simple, easy to understand description of rates, and kind of what they mean and why we should be concerned with them.
If you kind of think of digital captures of sound, almost like an XY graph. So yeah, so the sample rate is I guess, your x-axis is how many snapshots per second you're taking of that sound wave. The more snapshots we take per second of that sound wave, the more fidelity with which we can recreate it in the digital realm. And then the bit depth is going along the y-axis, so it's the amplitude, it's the loudness. A 0 dB sound is the loudest sound that you can get in 16-bit is still as loud as it is in 24-bit, but the resolution at which you can read the dynamic of those sounds, so the difference between the loudest and the quietest, you can do it at a greater detail the higher the bit depth you use. So the 16-bit was the CD standard, and then 24-bit is kind of, I suppose, the standard at the moment. But more and more, certainly mix engineers are sending me stuff that's 32-bit floating point now. So that's a higher resolution. It means we've got much more scope for the dynamics. The difference between that loudest and the quietest sound, all of the steps in between and the notches in between, the levels at which you can record stuff and reproduce them, there's a lot more detail there now. And and the more detail, and both ways with the sample rate and with the bit depth, means that there's a much richer palette at which we can reproduce sound in the digital realm, and that it will sound fuller and more dynamic and more rich. So there are arguments to be made. I think if you're like maybe doing an orchestral recording where you've got all these organic sounds in a beautiful room, you're going to want to do stuff really high res. You're going to want to do stuff at a really high sample rate. And also because the consumers of that audio are more likely to have a really top spec hi-fi. They might be listening in quite a quiet listening environment where they can feel the full effects of those, of all that dynamic richness and all of the kind of high sample rates. But at the same time, sometimes, you know, people get really hung up on doing everything, say, at 96K and 24-bit or 96K and 32-bit, doing stuff as high res as possible. But if the music is largely built on samples, and those samples were only ever recorded at 44.1, 16-bit, you know, by upsampling and up-resing those sounds, you're not going to add anything to them. If it's already digital, you can make all that extra gigabytes of digital audio and WAVs on your hard drive and slow your computer down with it, but it's, you're not really adding anything. And the same if the performance and the aesthetic of that record necessitates that the vocal needs to be super compressed and no dynamics at all and really distorted, and it just needs to sound like that, like a punk record or a, maybe like a grime record where it just needs that aggressive sound, then doing that kind of stuff at really high bit depth, the bit depth is there to capture dynamics. And if really nuanced dynamics aren't part of that record, I don't think we need to get too hung up on, you know, 96K 24-bit or 96K 32-bit versions of those records. The technology and everything that we do in the studio should fit first and foremost the compositions and the aesthetic of that. That is a piece of art at the end of the day, and that needs to be the most important thing. And it kind of goes back to what you said earlier about budget stuff. I know that we live in the real world and budgets matter, but sometimes recording at home, and if you've got a couple of mics kicking around and you've got a computer and an A to D where you can plug stuff in, that might be the perfect thing for that record. And you might have $100,000 sitting there where you could book a studio out, and you could have loads of session musicians and you could have the best producer around, but there's not really any such thing as the best producer. The best producer is whoever's right for that record. So maybe that record is supposed to be recorded in a living room with three instruments. Maybe those songs will sound the best it done that way, and maybe not mastering it with a fancy mastering engineer or mixing it with a fancy mix engineer. And then on the flip side, maybe there's another song that it needs to be that really polished kind of, everything needs to be recorded perfectly and everything needs to be really big budget, high production, sound really glossy. It just depends on the song. It's so important that none of us in the chain, from, you know, the manager, the A&R, the mastering guy, the mixer, the producer, everybody is on, it understands that piece of art and wants to make it sound like it's supposed to be, and that it fulfills the kind of the artist's, you know, vision of what they wanted to do. I think that's really important as well.
So what's the minimum, what do we upload our music as? I mean, everyone's, you know, working in MP3 for putting their stuff online. Is, you know, can we do it in 48K 24-bit? Does it need to be 44.1 16? Do our MP3s need to be 320? What's the kind of, when we've got a song and we've got our master, like, what's the sort of minimum requirements to get it onto places like SoundCloud and Spotify and iTunes?
I would say if you're delivering to a mastering engineer, do like kind of the reverse of what I've just said, but do always try and give them 24-bit at least, just because they've probably got a better way of dithering stuff than you do. And if you have recorded it at 16-bit and you didn't think about it at the time,